Okay, so I think we can start this evening's talk. Tonight I'm going to, what I'm going to do is to read out some of the similes of the Buddha taken from the Buddha's discourses. Those of you who know me reasonably well, you know that I often like to read the suttas and look at what the Buddha actually taught about the Dhamma, because it always strikes me when I look at Buddhism. Everybody says that this is my teacher, that is my teacher, this is my tradition, this is where I belong. But very few people say, I'm a disciple of the Buddha. But in the end, that's what we all are. We're all disciples of the Buddha in the end. So I like to encourage people to read the word of the Buddha. But to do that, it's important to read something inspiring, right? Something that catches you, something that you enjoy, that you like. Sometimes the suttas can seem a bit dry. You know, sometimes you read, the five of this or the six of that, and you feel, the same thing again. But those suttas too are actually very important and very interesting. But you have to start with the place that inspires you and then move towards the drier stuff later on, so you understand the whole picture of things. But to get started, it's often nice to read something which catches your attention, which you find is very nice. And one of the most beautiful things in the suttas that I like the most are the similes of the Buddha. And they are very apt usually, very to the point. They're very lifelike. Similes are often taken from daily life, right? You can relate to them straight away. You know what this is about. It's very simple to understand. And sometimes the most complex of concepts can be relayed with a very simple simile. And straight away you understand, now I know what this is about. So it speaks to you in a very direct and very immediate way. And often it's also more kind of, it brings up more emotions, right, a simile, because it has a kind of, it's a more real life content. So when you read these things, it can be very powerful. So that's why I thought of luring you in to reading the Dhamma by reading some similes for you. So if after this you go back and you want to read some suttas after you hear this talk tonight, then I will have succeeded. If you don't want to read any suttas, then it's been a complete failure. But let's see what happens anyway. Let's see how this goes. So this is a slightly structured sequence of similes. And the first one I have chosen, it goes as follows. And this particular simile is about the Buddha's realization of the Dhamma, the understanding of Nibbana, and also the understanding of the ending of rebirth and all defilements, etc. So this is a simile for that. When the Buddha first, the beginning of the Dhamma, right, the beginning of the thing we call Buddhism, this is how it started. And this is the simile for how it all started. Okay, suppose bhikkhus is monks, right? A man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts. A delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a royal minister, "Sir, know that while I was wandering through the forest, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled upon by people in the past. I followed it and saw an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts. A delightful place. Renovate that city, sir." Then the king or the royal minister would renovate the city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So that is the simile of the Buddha, of how he discovered the Dhamma, right? And I find this so wonderful, this idea of you're wandering through the jungle, right? And you find this ancient city. It's like an adventure, right? It's like one of these Indiana Jones movies or something like that. I don't know if you've seen the Indiana Jones movies. You go through this and you find this ancient treasure somewhere. And this is what this is like. It's an adventure. And of course, if you think about the Dhamma is also really an adventure, right? We're moving towards something beautiful. We're moving towards the purity of the mind. We're moving towards states of mind that are wonderfully profound and delightful. It's an adventure. And with every step on the way, it's like we uncover something beautiful. We see something profound. We find this ancient city, this beautiful old city inside of ourselves. That's what we are kind of heading towards. And if you have that sense of adventure when you practice the Dhamma, then it becomes quite exciting, right? You meditate and you just wait and see what happens. And all these wonderful things start to happen inside of you. You practice virtue, not because you have to practice virtue, because it is an adventure. It's something wonderful to follow this path, to move toward these beautiful things. So this is like the first thing that I read, I think, when I see the sutta. I think of this beautiful thing that we're all moving towards, the sense of adventure that we all have. And one of the other things that I like about this sutta is the fact that it talks about an ancient path, right? The path here is obviously the Noble Eightfold Path. It's the path that we all have to travel to move towards awakening. Buddha, Bodhi, means awakening, quite literally. To move towards awakening, we all have to travel on this Eightfold Path to get to the ancient city. So this is an ancient path. It's always been there. The path is always there. It is just waiting for somebody to discover that path. So the Buddha himself, it wasn't as if he invented this path for the first time. He just discovered something that has always been there. So it follows there would have been Buddhas in the past. There would have been large number of Buddhas in the past, going back to, you know, time immemorial, so to speak. And of course, there will be more Buddhas in the future, because sometimes, occasionally, some person has developed themselves so much that they're able to break through to this. And then they make the breakthrough, following that same ancient path. And for me, this is one of those things that makes Buddhism quite unique in the world. Most religions, you find that there is like one savior, right? One savior, he exists now, in our time, in our culture perhaps even. And for me, that is, if you have like one savior, it's a bit like self-centered, right? We are important. You must be important, right? If the savior has come just in your time and in your culture, it is something slightly, in my opinion, maybe I'm being a bit naughty for saying this, but for me, it's slightly self-centered idea. But this view that Buddhism or the Eightfold Path, it comes and it goes, it always recurs, to me, has the flavor of truth to it. This is how things really are in the world. We are not actually especially important. We are just ordinary people. We are ordinary beings, just like everyone else. We're not unimportant either. We just are beings like anyone else. Things come and things go. And this is one of the things that I always found when I came to Buddhism. This makes sense. This is one of the ways in which Buddhism stands out and has a particular flavor of truth to it that often is difficult to find elsewhere. So the Buddha then walks this path. He finds this ancient city. And then he renovates it, right? He says to the kings and the king's ministers, these are all the disciples, right, of the Buddha. He says, go and renovate that city. In other words, find the path yourself. Build it up, discover the same truth. And then gradually the city becomes beautiful again, full of people, full of life. And these are all the disciples practicing in the same way, populating, if you like, the city of Nibbana. This is like the city of Nibbana. This is metaphorical, right? Nibbana is not really a city, but it is. You get the idea. It's lots of people realizing the Dhamma, right? And then it becomes a beautiful place again, expanded and well populated. So that is the discovery of the Dhamma. And of course, once you have discovered the Dhamma, it also follows that you discover the path. The path is part of the Dhamma. So once the discoverer is there, the Buddha has arisen, then the Dhamma comes into existence. The Dhamma is essentially the teaching of the Buddha, the most important part of which is the path itself. So the next simile I want to talk about is a simile for this path of Buddhism. And I will talk a little bit more in detail about this path afterwards. So this is a simile for the path, and this is a simile for the development of the mind on this path. Bhikkhus, monks, there are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it, and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled, and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy and luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. But as the goldsmith or his apprentice continues to fan, melt, and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then, whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So, that is the path of Buddhism, explained very briefly in terms of the refining of gold, right? Now, remember what we're talking about here is the refinement of the mind, right? This is a simile for the refinement of the mind. And the first thing that strikes me when I read this sutta is that the mind here is compared to gold, right? And that is not accidental. I don't think the Buddha's words are never really accidental. The Buddha always says that his words are specially crafted to have a special meaning. So these things are not accidental. So the mind is like gold. How can the mind be like gold? And the reason is that the mind, when it is developed, is something that is very beautiful and very radiant, and that leads to enormous happiness for human beings. Just like gold in the world is one of the most valuable things that people can have in the world, the mind is much, much more valuable than that. And that is why it is here likened to gold, right? The happiness, the beauty, the radiance of the mind is something very special when it is developed to the limit. So gold is just a poor kind of second cousin to the mind here when it's developed properly. In other places in the suttas, you find that the mind is compared to a diamond as well, right? A diamond, something very clear, you can see through it, a very beautiful thing. The diamond is also very hard. Now why, so is the mind hard? The mind is hard in the sense that the mind in samadhi, the mind in meditation, is a mind which is very solid, very unshakable, very unmovable. Just like a diamond is very strong, very unshakable, very immovable, in exactly the same way. So you find that the mind, when the mind is purified, it is likened to all these most precious things that we can think of in our ordinary earthly life, so to speak. So this is the first thing that always strikes me about this simile, how the mind is something very powerful and precious. The second thing, which is very clear from the simile, is that there is a gradual process of purification that you have to go through. And that process is not random. It is a gradual sequence, and you have to follow that sequence, right? You have to start with the coarse stuff. You've got to get the coarse gravel and things out first. Then you can go on to the more refined things, the sand and the dirt. Then you can go on to the very refined black dust, as it says in here. There is a sequence, and you have to follow that sequence, right? You can't start with the most refined dust. That doesn't work. You start with the core stuff. And it is exactly the same thing here in our development of meditation, or not just meditation, but any development of the mind. You have to follow a certain sequence. If you don't follow the sequence, it's not going to work. So you have to start with the most coarse defilements. Then you have to move on to the middling defilements, and only then can you work with the most refined defilements. So you have to look inside of yourself. You have to know yourself. Where am I at? What are my problems? You have to be very honest with yourself, right? There's no point in pretending that you are better than you actually are. If you start pretending, you're not going to make any progress. You've got to be, as they say, brutally honest, right? You've got to see the truth as it actually is. And then you know what you need to do. Do I have a problem with anger? Do I sometimes get angry? Okay, that is a coarse defilement. What can I do with that? And then you start to think of ways of dealing with anger. We come a little bit back to this later on. There are many beautiful ways of dealing with anger and irritation. And then there are other things in the mind, more kind of refined irritations perhaps, or maybe too much craving. And all of these things, just gradually, you move away from these things. So self-knowledge is such an important thing, because then you can know where on the path you are, and you know what you need to do to purify yourself. And the point of this simile here, and one of the very important points that I find with this, is also that you understand from this why it is that meditation works sometimes and why other times it doesn't work. And you realize that it's all got to do with defilements, right? The path is about removing defilements. This is what we're really doing here. And if you think that, you know, you're trying to watch the breath, or you're trying to do metta meditation or whatever, and it doesn't work, the reason is because you haven't removed enough defilements yet. It's a path of removing defilements. That is what it's all about. And if the path doesn't work, if you're not getting the results, it's because there are defilements there that you haven't gotten rid of yet. That's the reason. It's not because you aren't watching the object in the right way. It's not because you haven't kind of figured out. I mean, to watch the breath is pretty easy, right? As people often want to find out, oh, what's the mechanism and the how to watch the breath? But watching the breath is, you can't get much simpler than that in life, you know? It's pretty straightforward. If it doesn't work, it's because of defilements. So you've got to work with the defilements. You've got to deal with that. And once you get used to, you're able to watch the breath, and once you see how it functions, you see it's the easiest thing to work in the world is to watch the breath when the defilements are very low, very subdued. So this is a very important point. It's not so much about technique, about what meditation object, it's about defilements that this path really is about. So you practice in this way, you subdue defilements, the meditation becomes more powerful, the mind becomes more beautiful, the goal is getting more and more refined, right? And as it gets more refined, it becomes more beautiful. The mind inside of you also becomes more beautiful as you refine it, as you get rid of the defilements. And then you put it in the melting pot, and you melt it and smelt it and all these kind of things. And eventually, as you do that, there's an interesting phrase here which I like. The time comes when the gold is settled, the dross has been entirely removed, right? The time comes. It's not a time of your choosing. It's not something that you can sort of hurry along and say, now I want to meditate properly. There comes a time. It happens by itself. It's not your choice. And what that means when you realize that it's all about there just comes a time is that you don't try to hurry the process. You just wait for the time to arrive, right? So this is like the patience aspect. You don't know when the time is, so you just wait instead. You cannot force this process. That's what this is saying. It happens when everything is ripe. And that is such a wonderful hint for how meditation practice works. Meditation practice works through patience. It doesn't work through trying to do the meditation. It works through being able to sit back and wait and allowing things to be, and allowing the process to take its own course. And then it will happen when the time is ripe. And then, when the time is ripe, then the gold is malleable. The mind is malleable, right? The mind is wieldy. You can work it. The mind will do exactly what you want. The mind is not going to be stubborn anymore, not going to be difficult anymore. It's, what does it say here? Malleable, wieldy, and luminous, pliant, and properly fit for work. In other words, the mind is going to do your bidding. Normally, the mind goes this way, it goes that way. Sometimes you feel completely out of control, right? You just don't know what's going on. This is what happens in the mind sometimes. And it's not a very nice feeling, but it's the way things are. It's okay, so you accept it. But at this point, it's the exact opposite. The mind is completely solid. It's completely under your control. And that is why this is the time when all the defilements have been removed. This is the time when you can actually penetrate the deep insights of the Dhamma. This is the time when your mind is completely still and ready for this. It's malleable, wieldy, it's radiant. Radiant here is pabhasara. Pabhasara is this word which means shiny, right? This is the mind without defilements. So that is the path for you, the path of practice not in great detail, but the whole path is basically there, the removal of the defilements. So now I want to move on from there to a few similes that talk more specifically about the practice of the path. And I'm going to give them in sequence so that we start with the most basic and we end up with the very highest. I'm going to take you to the very highest today, if I have time, but I'm going to start with the basic things and then move up, because it is nice sometimes to hear these similes, because it gives a different feeling for these profound things. So the next one here is about virtue. So this is one of the nice similes in the suttas for virtue. Bhante, this is Venerable Ananda speaking to the Buddha. Bhante, there are these three fragrances that spread with the wind, but not against the wind. What three? The fragrance of roots, the fragrance of heartwood, and the fragrance of flowers. Is there any fragrance that spreads with the wind, against the wind, and both with and against the wind? There is, Ananda. But Bhante, what is that fragrance? Here, Ananda, in whatever village or town, a woman or a man has gone for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, and the Sangha. He or she is virtuous and of good character, abstaining from the destruction of life, abstaining from taking what is not given, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from false speech, abstaining from liquor, wine, and intoxicants, the basis for heedlessness. And he or she dwells at home with a heart devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. In such a case, ascetics and Brahmins, this is like wise people, right? Wise people in all the different directions speak their praise, saying, in such and such a village, a woman or a man has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and they are virtuous of good character, delighting in giving and sharing. The deities too, the devas, the deities too speak their praise, saying, in such and such a village or town, a man or a woman has gone for refuge to the Triple Gem, is of virtuous and good character, delighting in giving and sharing. This, Ananda, is the fragrance that spreads with the wind, against the wind, and both with and against the wind. So, there you are, the fragrance of virtue, the fragrance of goodness, the fragrance of kindness, that spreads out into the world. And it says many places in the suttas that one of the great benefits of being a good person is that, of course, you get a good reputation, right? People will talk things, good, say good things about you. I always think about in the monastery, sometimes we may talk about somebody. And usually if we talk about somebody, we say, oh, marvelous, this person is, you know, somebody who is a very good character. And you mention them simply because it's a nice memory. It's a nice thought to think about somebody who is kind. It makes you feel good inside, right? Of course, this doesn't mean that everybody is going to say kind things about you just because you are kind and a good person. There's always going to be people who say negative things about you. That's just life. You can't avoid that. Even the Buddha was sometimes condemned for things that he hadn't done, and was people would go up to the Buddha's face and they would be angry with him and shout at him. Of course, the Buddha didn't flinch, but even for the Buddha, sometimes he had to deal with these difficulties. So, of course, let alone us, we have to deal with these things much more. But the point is that it is the wise people that will talk about you in a good way. It is the wise people that will spread the good rumor of somebody who is virtuous and kind. And then it is the people who are deluded, who don't understand the power of virtue, who don't understand the power of goodness and kindness, those people are the ones who then might criticize you for being good. So it's the wise ones. But isn't that what we really want? The wise people to say good things about us? Who cares if some kind of deluded person says something funny? Okay, it always hurts a little bit, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, right? But if the wise people talk good about us, that is what really matters. Because wise people, from a Buddhist point of view, they are the ones who understand what truly is happiness in the world, what truly is suffering, what leads to our own good and welfare, what leads to the welfare and goodness of other people. That is the definition of wisdom in the suttas. Somebody who understands what leads us towards the goal that we're all aspiring for. Freedom from problems, more happiness, more contentment, more fulfillment inside, right? One of the things about life is we never really feel fulfilled. That's why we crave so much. We want to kind of fulfill ourselves, feel complete through craving and amassing things. It never actually works. But here, of course, this is the way that you find this completion, through this virtue. And this is what the wise people understand. So the fragrance spreads out in the world. You are a fragrant person if you are virtuous. Isn't that nice? Don't have to take any showers. All you have to do is just be virtuous. And you're in business. You're fragrant. I wouldn't recommend that. You've got to do both things. But this, of course, is the much more important fragrance, right? The fragrance of virtue. Okay, so that is the first aspect of the Buddhist path. We always talk about, we start with virtue on the Buddhist path. And when virtue is established, first of all, virtue means body, speech, and also mind. But then the mental virtue then is a separate thing as well. So the next thing on the path, once you have established the virtue of the body and speech, then comes the mental virtue. And the next passage here is a simile to help us to improve our mental virtue. How can we be compassionate with people who are difficult in the world, right? Sometimes this is important to understand, because then we can overcome so many of the problems that we have with others. The biggest problems in life are usually with other people. So this is called removing resentment. And it goes as follows. This is the Venerable Sariputta, by the way, who speaks this particular sutta. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily, verbal, and mental behavior are impure? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily, verbal, and mental behavior are impure, on that occasion, one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body, after death, he will not be reborn in a bad destination." So, there you are. How to deal with people who are really difficult. Sometimes we all have those people in our lives. People who we cannot see anything good in. They seem to have all bad qualities. And it's very difficult to sort of see anything good in these people. And then what do we do? What we do is, instead of then despairing and saying, "I cannot have metta towards this person," I should say something about metta first of all, because this is part of this as well. How do you practice metta towards other people? And the only way that we can ever practice metta is by seeing something good in somebody else, right? If you cannot see anything good in somebody, it's impossible to have a sense of love towards that person, or kindness toward that person is also difficult. Kindness and gentleness and love, they come from seeing something beautiful in another person. So the first thing to do with anybody is always to try to find, is there anything beautiful in this person? And you will often find that in the vast majority of people, the vast majority, I would say, you can always find something nice, something beautiful, right? And then you focus in on that. You hone in on this tiny little beautiful thing, if it's only a small thing. Or if it's a saintly person, you just look at the whole personality and say, "Wow, this is beautiful." And then when you see the beauty, that is when you can have metta, right? That's how metta arises. And you will have noticed, that's how I started the metta meditation. You start off by thinking of the good qualities in somebody else, the spiritual good qualities. And then when you think of that, then you realize, this person is worthy of my kindness. And when they are worthy of your kindness, then you can come from your heart, you can have the intention, "May you be happy, may you be well." If you don't think they're worthy of your kindness, it's impossible to wish them well. You have to really feel that they are worthy of your kindness and metta. So you focus on the good qualities. So this is the first thing. Find the good qualities. Focus on that. Forget about the bad qualities. The very fact that somebody has a good quality is wonderful enough in its own right. But then comes the person who hasn't got those good qualities, or at least you can't see them, right? That amounts to the same thing. So what do? You don't get angry, you don't get upset, you don't think, why are they treating me so badly? What do you do instead? You think, this is like a sick person. They are ill. They don't have an attendant. They don't have the right food. They don't have anybody to look after them. They are on the way to their grave. There's nothing that can happen. You can't, if this continues, they are going straight to die right there and then. How do you feel when you see a person like that who is in very dire straits and things are very terrible? You want to help, right? Compassion arises inside of you. You want to do something. That is what compassion is. When you see somebody who, for no fault of their own, they are in a terrible situation. That is what compassion is. And that is how you look upon this person. You think of them, "Wow, this person is about to go to a bad destination because of their terrible conduct. What a terrible thing that is." And this is very skillful, because very often when people around us are difficult and hard to deal with, we often tend to focus on ourselves, right? We think, "Oh, it is so painful to be around this person." And we become self-centered and we think about our problem. But this is about turning the whole thing around. It's looking at their problem instead. Because the reality is that their problem is far, far, far greater than our problem. They are in really deep trouble. Whereas we can maybe just go somewhere else, get out of their sights, and maybe even change the job if we have to, or whatever it is. There's always something you can do to minimize contact when somebody is just too difficult. So you do that. Sometimes that's okay to do, because sometimes it's just too hard. And then you build up the compassion, the understanding instead. Instead of being self-centered, you focus outwards. And then you find that you feel far better for having that compassion instead of being self-centered and thinking, poor me, I have to be around this person. This is very beautiful. And if you take this to the extreme, if you always look at the good in people wherever it is, and if you always have compassion for those people where you cannot see anything good, if you do this all the time, then there is no person in this world that you ever will be angry with, right? Because all people fall into these categories. All people are included in this. Nobody is outside of this. So use this thing. It's such a simple thing, right? Think about it. It's so simple, really. It's not very difficult. And yet, how many people can actually do it? So you have to invest some time to actually develop this perception. You have to learn to think like this. And as you learn to think like this, gradually, you will actually be able to follow such a simple teaching. This is what this is about. And then your mind changes. Your mind becomes more positive, more understanding, more forgiving, more compassionate, and becomes so much nicer to be you. You feel so much nicer inside of yourself when that happens. Isn't that what this path is all about? You feel nicer and you become a blessing for the world around you. Wow, it couldn't get much better than that. So there you are. That's a simile for the person who is very difficult. They are ill. They are sick. They are walking towards their death. So then, coming back again to this idea of following the Buddhist path, you're purifying your virtue, you're purifying your mind, and there comes a point when meditation starts to become possible. And this next thing here is a simile for how meditation actually works. So this goes as follows. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man would catch 6 animals with different habitats and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. He would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey, and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, he would bind them to a strong post or pillar. Then those 6 animals with 6 different habitats and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground and habitat. The snake would pull one way, thinking, let me enter the anthill. The crocodile would pull another way, thinking, let me enter the water. The bird would pull another way, thinking, let me fly up into the sky. The dog would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a village. The jackal would pull another way, thinking, let me enter the charnel ground. And the monkey would pull another way, thinking, let me enter the forest. Now, when these 6 animals become worn out and fatigued, they would stand close to that post or pillar. They would sit down there. They would lie down there. So this is a simile for meditation practice. So what is the point of these animals? These animals are like the 6 senses, right? The eye pulls you out towards forms. Either you like the form or you don't like the form. In either way, there is craving. Craving to push it away or craving to achieve it. The sounds through the ear, the nose, the odors through the nose, the tastes with the tongue, the tangibles with the body, and also the mental phenomena. You know, craving in the mind. You know, you think about something beautiful, not spiritual beautiful things, but sensual beautiful things. And each sense is trying to sort of win over the other one, right? You see something nice, you hear something, and the mind is always pulled along. And you can see this very well in your meditation practice. You see what happens. You sit there peacefully, right? And a sound arises, and your mind goes out to the sound. You hear some nice music, or you think, oh, nice music. And you say, wait, I'm not supposed to listen to the music. And you pull yourself back in again. Or the mind goes out to the body because you have a pain in the body. Who doesn't have pain in the body sometimes in meditation practice? We all have that. But the mind goes out to the body, right? Why? Because there's business, there's something to be done, there's something which isn't nice, there's something repulsive happening in the body. So what we are doing here, we are because the mind always tends to go out into the senses, we need this pillar in the ground. And this pillar in the ground is mindfulness directed at certain objects. This is what the word satipatthana means. Satipatthana means the directing of mindfulness towards certain objects. And the object that is mentioned here is the body. And the body includes the breath. So this includes the breath meditation. It can also be other objects, but the breath meditation is one of the most important ones. And that is often said to complete and fulfill the satipatthana practice. So this is the breath meditation, right? So imagine it's the breath meditation. And then the noise comes there, and you say, stop, no, back to the breath again. And as you do the breath meditation, things start to become peaceful, right? And when things start to become peaceful, it's like you have something beautiful inside of yourself. And when something beautiful arises inside of yourself, there is less pull of the senses outside. Why do you want to listen to that music? Why do you worry about the body? Why do you worry about fantasizing about this and that when the present moment is peaceful and nice? So the senses start to calm down. This is the dog doesn't pull so strongly on the leash anymore. The crocodile isn't as interested in going into the water anymore, right? They're starting to calm down. The rope is starting to become less tense. And the more profound that stillness inside. And then the joy comes inside, right? Now, if you get joy in your meditation practice, then why search for the happiness of the senses outside? The joy is coming inside instead. So again, the external senses become less important. They calm down even more. And eventually, you come to the point where all the animals just lie down peacefully around the post, around the mindfulness. You're watching the breath, and the senses are no longer disturbing you, right? The reason why you're interested in the senses is because you think there's something to be had, when what you really want can be found inside instead. There's no reason to go outside anymore, and everything calms down. Your mind unifies, and you get into a beautiful and deep state of meditation practice. Again, it's a very simple simile, isn't it? The simile of the animals, pulling this way, pulling that way. It's so simple, but it's so easy to understand. Rather than reading the theory of the suttas, it becomes alive. Suddenly, you know what's going on. So next time you meditate, think about the animals. Think about the crocodile, the snake, pulling in different directions. And that might help you to understand what's going on. And then the mind becomes very peaceful. And it is at this point that you have the opportunity to go into very, very deep stages of meditation practice. And now we're coming to the conclusion, right, of this whole training that we have to go through. So now we're coming to the very end. So this is the second last of the similes that I want to speak about this evening, and this is what happens when the mind is very powerful through deep meditation. You have achieved the deep meditation, but what happens then? Suppose, on even ground at the crossroads, a chariot was standing harnessed to thoroughbreds, with the goad ready at hand, so that a skillful trainer, a charioteer, could mount it, and taking the reins in his left hand and the goad in his right, might drive out and return wherever and whenever he likes. So too, bhikkhus, when the deep samadhi has been developed and cultivated, then a person is capable of realizing any state of knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. So it is like your mind is like a chariot standing ready to go wherever you want, right? This is what I was saying before. When the defilements aren't there anymore, all you have to do is incline the mind in the right direction. And the mind sees whatever you want it to see. Anything, any insight you want to have is available to you at this point. Just like a chariot with the thoroughbred horses will take you wherever you want to go, so the mind will take you wherever you want to go, whatever insight you want to have. That is the power of the mind at this stage. And that is why you often see in the suttas that the Noble Eightfold Path, it ends with samadhi. It ends with the deep meditations. Because at that point, the mind is so powerful, it can do whatever you like. Go wherever you want. So what is it that what is it that you see when this happens? And this is the last simile, very, very short simile, of what you see when you take the reins of the chariot and you drive out to find those profound insights. This is what happens. Just as if there were a lake in a mountain recess, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, so that a man with good or a woman with good sight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, and pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about and resting. In the same way, you can see all these things that you wish to see with insight. So it is like a mountain recess, a mountain lake, right? I don't know if you have seen the mountain lakes. Myself, I grew up in Norway. In Norway, we have all these mountains. On these mountains, we have all these lakes. These lakes are very, very pure and very clear in the mountains, right? You look inside, and it's like you can see, you know, 5 or 6 meters down, and it's as if there's nothing between you and the bottom. And so you look in there, and you see everything. So this is like the mind, right? The mind is absolutely clear. When you look into the mind, you can see all the factors in there. You can see the body exactly for what it is. Everything is absolutely clear. There's nothing that disturbs you anymore. The lake is undisturbed and clear. And you see the shoals of fish moving around, right? The shoals of fish moving around. It's like the mind moving. And then the shoals of fish standing still and resting. It's like the mind resting in samadhi. And you see this. You see the movement. You see how it goes from one phase to another one. You see the conditionality that lies behind the movement. And you see, of course, most important of all, that there is nothing in there that is solid, nothing in there that isn't conditioned, nothing in there that isn't just a flux moving around all the time. That is what you see. The mind has become absolutely clear. Very simple, isn't it? It's a very simple explanation of this thing we call awakening or enlightenment or becoming an arahant or whatever you want to call it. It's so simple. All it is having this absolute clarity about what is going on. That's all there's to it, really, according to the sutta. Which is a wonderful way of looking at awakening, because sometimes it seems so obscure. What is it really all about? This is what it's about. Clarity. Absolute clarity here. Okay, so that was my last simile for this evening. And there are many, many more where this came from. This is just my PR for the suttas. Many, many more in there. So the purpose is just to get you a sense, a feeling for what's actually found in these suttas, what actually is there, and sometimes how direct and easy to understand it is. Not everything in the suttas is so easy to understand. Everything is easy to understand on like a superficial level, but to understand everything fully and deeply can sometimes take time. But my point is that regardless, you will gain enormously from reading these things. This is our kind of final refuge as Buddhists, right? This is the final thing. This is the final teachings standing behind all the other teachings that we hear here at the Buddhist Society or that you hear anywhere else. Any teaching today gains its validity, gains its credibility, gains its authenticity because it is related to these teachings here from the suttas. This is like the credibility test for all other teachings, essentially. That's why they are so powerful. So I encourage you all, if you have a chance, to have a look at these things, especially if you found these things tonight useful. If you didn't, you maybe it's not for you. Not everybody likes to read the suttas, and that's okay as well. Anyway, that's my talk for this evening here. Okay, so would anybody like to comment on anything or ask any questions or tell me off for saying the wrong thing or something. Anybody have anything they would like to say here? The Buddha, one thing the Buddha said, he said, I'm sure Ajahn Brahma said this many times before, but he said that if you want to be intelligent in the future life, you should ask questions in this life. So how many people want to be intelligent here? This is now the the crucial question here. Anybody have any question here? Everybody happy here? Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, Dai. Thank you.
We often think of defilements as being very fiery, like anger and craving.
Yeah.
Is sadness a defilement? Because it disturbs the mind quite a bit. And if it is, then why? Because it doesn't seem like a defilement.
I think sadness is like a secondary thing here. Sadness is usually it comes because you have craving or you have attachment to something, right? So your parent or your family member, your husband, your wife passes away, you feel sad afterwards. And the sadness is a secondary thing which comes from defilement at the deepest level, comes from the attachment, comes from the desire that you have for the person. So what you have to deal with, so not the sadness so much, but actually it's the attachment that you have to deal with in that situation. Yeah. Anybody else would like to say anything? Everybody happy? Okay. At the back. Okay, but maybe the back first there. Yeah.
Just a quick one. Regarding the story about the goldsmith, you spoke repeatedly about the apprentice as well.
Thanks. And I was just wondering from the repetition of that if there was a significance.
That's a good point. There's the goldsmith and his apprentice. Maybe what it just means is that maybe the Buddha is sometimes regarded as the goldsmith. He purifies the gold first, and then the apprentice is like the anybody who comes afterwards practicing the path. Possibly. I'm not sure if that is the meaning. It may also be just one of the things about the Pali language, the way it is found in the suttas, is often very repetitive. And the reason for that is because it was used to be an oral tradition. It was passed on orally from generation to generation. And if you repeat things and if you use synonyms, then it tends to get memorized more easily, and the content is more easily memorized. Like, that is another possible explanation.
Sounds plausible. Thank you.
Yeah.
My understanding
of similes is more basic. It's like, you know, bright as the sunshine or like this. Yeah. This English way of seeing. Yeah. As in light. Yeah. Whereas what you're would be stories. Right, yeah. I think, you know, there are metaphors and there are similes and all of these things are kind of just different kind of degrees of the same thing, you know, metaphors, similes, what else do you call it, stories. There are other words for these things as well. What are these words?
Allegories,
exactly, allegories, all these kind of things, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't find them that quickly or easily when you're reading. There's a lot of didactic repetition,
yeah.
Like you said before.
Yeah, so that's okay, because that sort of livens it up. Suddenly you come to a nice simile, and suddenly everything's come nicely together, right? So that's what you have to do. One of the most important things is also to find a collection of suttas that is easy to read. And one of the books that I always recommend is In the Buddha's Words, a translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. That's one of the best ones. You read that one? Okay, good on you. That's that's great. Okay, let's take a few questions from many different places. First one is from Blake in the U.S., how do we cope with tainted people who take advantage of us, who are compassionate, patient, and mindful? Okay, so they are both tainted and compassionate, patient, and mindful. Okay, maybe they aren't as compassionate, patient, and mindful as you think, if they are that tainted. So if somebody takes advantage of you, then it's not really compassion, is it? At the very best, it is misunderstood compassion. And as we often say in Buddhism, wisdom is the highest kind, most important thing. Because often, compassion without wisdom is blind. And this might be one of those blind compassions, right? What isn't really real compassion is just kind of make-believe compassion. So how do you cope with people like that? Well, you just have to, I don't know, it depends on who it is, right? If it is a situation, if you can't deal with it, you have to sort of withdraw a little bit, right? Withdraw, protect yourself. Don't allow people to take advantage of you. change your job if you have to, get divorced if you have to. It's okay to get divorced if it gets too difficult, or at least have a holiday from your spouse, maybe first of all, and then see how things go. And then you can use some of the techniques I was talking about here. Remember that if somebody really is taking advantage of you, they are the one who have the problem, right? They are the one who really have the problem inside. So understand that. And then instead of focusing on your own suffering, you can focus on the bad karma that this person is making for themselves. Then you can have compassion. Then you don't feel so self-centered anymore. It's a wonderful thing not to be so self-centered. It's a terrible thing to always be closed inside of yourself, feeling poor me. It's not nice. So if you can get out of that, it's a wonderful thing. So use these skillful teachings. See the good, have metta about that. If there isn't anything good, then have compassion. If necessary, get a bit more distance because you feel like you are drowning in this other person's presence. If you are drowning in the presence, you have to get a bit of space for yourself, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. Okay, then we have Guy from Australia. He says, how can I sharpen my mindfulness to see defilements and hindrances as they arise? How do I identify the causes of those defilements? And how do I prevent them from growing? Okay, one place to start is just by reading the suttas. You read the suttas and then you're already on the way, as they say here. So sharpening the mindfulness, becomes sharper by reducing the defilements, right? So it's a catch-22 situation. You have to reduce the defilements. Then mindfulness becomes sharper. Then you can see the defilements better. Then you can reduce them more. So it's a gradual thing. And as you progress on the path, things that you never even dreamt of as defilements become clear to you. These things are defilements. And then you can start to work on those as well. So what you have to do is initially, if the defilements are too many and your mindfulness isn't that strong, you have to use the kind of techniques I was talking about today, about how to deal with somebody who is difficult. So you don't get angry and upset. Instead, you understand and you have compassion. And it isn't that difficult to do. It takes a bit of investment. It takes a bit of hard work. But once you put in that hard work, anyone can do this. It's not rocket science, as they say. This is just using your emotional intelligence to work these things out. And then the defilements go down. Your mindfulness increases. You see more, right? When you see more, you can sort of go after the more refined defilements, stage by stage. This is what the spiritual path really, to a large extent, is all about. And then you go on a meditation retreat. And you reduce your defilements. Next time you come back on meditation retreat, your meditation improves. You can see that you're getting somewhere. And everything becomes very nice. Okay. So, then we have Dhirayupa from Thailand. Okay, she has stayed at Bodhidharma Monastery before, so I know Dhirayupa. Hello, Dhirayupa, if you're out there. Ajahn, please explain why we could restrain expressing our irritation and anger at acquaintances, but we cannot do that with people who are close to us. How do we overcome this? Okay, that's a very good question, isn't it? How the people who are closest to us often are the most difficult to hold back our irritation and anger. It's because they are so close, because the habit is so ingrained, right? They have said this thing to me a million times before, and every time you get upset, it's like a pattern engraved in your mind, engraved in your brain. You cannot just undo it. So the habit is very powerful. That is why it is so difficult. So basically, what you have to do is you have to just, again, try to use these kind of teachings. Try to understand that actually they are just being themselves. Probably they don't want to hurt you. It's just that they are acting out who they are. And it's difficult to change, right? Sometimes when we think about how other people should change and how they're not doing things the right way, what we need to do is just look inside of ourselves and ask ourselves, how easy is it really to change? It's pretty difficult sometimes, isn't it? So things can be so ingrained. So do we have any right to demand of others that they should change when we know how difficult it is? Probably not. Probably they're doing their best already. They just can't help themselves, basically. And when you understand that they can't help themselves, and that they may be making bad karma as well through not being able to help themselves. Again, you can have understanding, you can have compassion, and then you can forgive, and then you can let go, right? So there are so many skillful ways in Buddhism. You just have to use all those techniques that are available there. And many of them are actually very simple. It's just about applying yourself, and eventually you will get there. So that is my answer to that one. Any last questions? Eddie, at the back here. Do you want the microphone, Eddie? I'm not sure if you need the microphone, but you'll get it anyway. So...
Ajahn Brumley, I've been wanting to ask this question for some time now.
Okay.
You know, the path towards enlightenment, okay?
Mm.
We have the Eightfold Path.
Mm.
Okay, yeah. And then we have, from the suttas, that's the four foundations of mindfulness.
Mm.
Then there's the five aggregates.
Yeah.
And then the Bojangga, seven factors towards enlightenment.
Mm.
I find, maybe it's only to me, you know, okay? Yeah. I find the Eightfold Path is more long-winded, you know. Whereas the others are more like a shortcut. like that's a tool for you, you know.
Yeah.
That's the tool, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the four foundations of mindfulness.
Okay.
You know. Whereas it's just like an Eightfold Path. Yeah. It's just like, for example, you take a boat across the river, that's enlightenment, all right? Eightfold Path is, you know, you've got to go through that path, the hill, blah, 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 and take that boat. Whereas the others are, here you are, that's the boat, you know, just sail across.
Yeah.
Am I right to say this thing?
No.
That's what I find.
No, okay. It is true that the Noble Eightfold Path is longer, but the reason why it's longer is because it's more complete, right? It has more details of the path into it. It is a full path. Remember when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths? It's the Eightfold Path that are part of the Four Noble Truths. This is like the main teaching, the Four Noble Truths. Everything else fits into the Four Noble Truths. So when you think about the four foundations of mindfulness, they are just one aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. They are sammasati, right mindfulness. That's where they fit in, only one aspect. If you look at the bojangas are really about samadhi. If you look at the bojangas, they're all about the experience of samadhi, how samadhi arises in the mind. So they fit in also with sammasati overlapping into sammasamadhi. That's where the bojangas are. So all the other kind of groupings we're talking about, the five aggregates, actually doesn't really... It fits in more with right view. It's about understanding the nature of suffering. That's what five aggregates are all about. So all of these other things are like expansions, if you like, of the Noble Eightfold Path, of the Four Noble Truths. And they are not the full path in their own right. Only the Noble Eightfold Path is the full path. So please don't forget about the Noble Eightfold Path and just do Satipatthana, because you may end up not getting anywhere at all.
One more quick thing, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Also, in our practice, we have to bear in mind, you know, the four stages towards enlightenment, you know. Sakadami, Sotapanna, Sakadami, Anagami, and Arahant, isn't it? So, like, we have to be true to ourselves, we can't force ourselves, you know. You understand?
Yeah, but these are...
Whether we are stream entrant or returner, non-returner, or Arahant, so we have to sort of...
I wouldn't worry too much about those things, because these things are so profound. It's very, very rare to find anyone, anywhere.
I agree.
Even monastics, let alone lay people, who actually have attained any of these things. It's extremely rare. Yeah, I know, you know, having been a monk for almost 20 years, I know a lot of people who practice really well, get very, very deep meditation, very deep insight, and yet they haven't achieved any of these things. So don't worry too much about these stages. Just practice in the right way, and these things will happen in their own time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, maybe that's enough for this evening, so let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.